I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. He served 12 years as a district attorney and 12 years as a U.S. representative. Now, former Congressman Dennis Moore is focusing his energies on another battle closer to home, Alzheimer's. Earlier this month, Moore announced he is one of more than 5 million Americans who are living with the disease. Today, the former congressman and his wife, Stephanie, talk with us about the signs, his diagnosis, and what it means for them. Coming up, Dennis and Stephanie Moore and an Alzheimer's expert talk about the disease, resources for those who suffer, and their efforts to bring more attention to diagnosis and treatment of Alzheimer's. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Former Congressman Dennis Moore stunned his home state of Kansas and much of the Midwest with his announcement earlier this month that he's suffering from Alzheimer's. "This is the hand I've been dealt," Moore told me in an interview on the day he made his announcement. Moore, who is 66, said he was diagnosed in June, just 6 months after leaving a six-term career in the U.S. House. That career followed a stint as Johnson County District Attorney and more time as a member of the Johnson County Community College Board of Trustees. These days, a challenge for the former congressman is to exercise, which is thought to be helpful in warding off the effects of Alzheimer's. And he wants to talk about the disease in an effort to demystify it and educate the public. Today, we're joined once again by Dennis Moore. Congressman, welcome. So good to have you here again.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be with you.
And joining him is his wife, Stephanie Moore. Stephanie, welcome to you, too.
Thanks, Steve.
And also with us is Michelle Needon. She's Director of Programs and Public Policy for the Alzheimer's Association, the Heart of America chapter. And Michelle, it's nice to have you too. Good morning. Well, the two of you are here today on the radio talking about this. You gave me an interview a couple of weeks back, Dennis, in which you disclosed this to the Kansas City area. What are you hoping to accomplish by going public? What do you want to see happen here?
What I really would like to see happen is to raise public awareness about this, and hopefully someday we'll find a, I don't know if a cure, but some way to better treat this horrible thing. I saw it in my dad. He died about, four or five years ago, honey. And he had Alzheimer's for the last two or three years of his life. Mm-hmm. And it was just a horrible thing to see. And I just hope that we can find a cure for cancer, a cure for Alzheimer's, and some of the other horrible diseases that confront mankind and womankind.
Stephanie, what else would you say about this? You're here today. Why?
Well, I'm supporting.
Those are all good reasons, right?
Yeah, those are good reasons.
Yeah.
And I think it's real important that we realize that this is a disease. It's out there. It's affecting, Michelle can correct me, about 5 million people in the United States. As we're getting older, 80 million baby boomers coming up the pike here pretty soon. We're going to see more and more of this. And it's important to realize it's there. We've got to talk about it, get it diagnosed early, and get the support we need.
You know, Congressman, on the day I was out at your home talking with you about this, you told me that, given what you just said about your father, that you sort of knew this train was coming down the road at you, perhaps at some point.
Well, I was hopeful it might not happen, but I suspected that it was very possible that it could, based upon what I've heard from about this and the hereditary factors involved. I expected this very well might happen. Unfortunately, it has.
Yeah. Hereditary, Michelle, is a big factor in Alzheimer's. Is there a close relationship there?
It is a significant factor. There are two types of Alzheimer's disease. There is a familial type that is heavily, heavily attached to genetic mutations. And there is a more common sporadic variety in which family history still plays a role but attaches to other risk factors for the disease to become alive. So genetics plays a role in both types, one more significant than the other.
So certainly if a parent had Alzheimer's, folks might want to be on the lookout. It's a warning sign, perhaps.
Well, it raises the risk of getting the disease. So, you know, we don't want to be too fearful. It's also the case that when someone has it in their family, oftentimes they interpret every forgetful moment as the possibility of the onset of Alzheimer's. So we don't want to react too diligently and become hypervigilant about that. But certainly it raises the risk factor and we pay attention.
How does one distinguish between just everyday forgetfulness and beginning to understand that someone might be suffering from Alzheimer's?
Well, wonderful question, because the answer to that has changed over the course of time and really depicts some great strides in the understanding of Alzheimer's disease. And that has led me to answer that question in that it's very difficult. And the key issue is differences between the skills, behaviors, and abilities prior. And the best indication we have that something is going on is when it deviates from the person, the ability, and skills that were existed before.
Dennis Moore, when did you begin to suspect that maybe you were suffering from Alzheimer's? How did that come to you?
Oh, I suppose just after I left Congress, really, I started to just wonder. I was seeing some people that I hadn't seen for a long time, and I'd known them in the past, but sometimes I couldn't remember their name. And that's what kind of raised some concerns in my own mind about this possibility.
And so, Stephanie, you guys went to – you had a preliminary checkup, if I remember right, in February of last year. What did you find out there?
Well, we were directed towards a really wonderful doctor who we're very happy with, and she helped us work through the diagnosis process, which really there is nothing that you can do to diagnose Alzheimer's. You have to rule out other things. And because of other issues in Dennis's family, we weeded through everything and then Dennis went through some sit-down testing and finally got the second opinion through an expert in St. Louis and got the diagnosis in June 1st.
That was June of last year.
Correct.
Last summer.
Just last summer.
When you got that diagnosis, Congressman, how was that for you?
Well, I won't say it was exactly good news because nobody wants to hear something like that. On the other hand, I think that I've been aware for a long time that some of this can be hereditary, and my dad had it, so I expected that it was possible that I might at some point get it too.
So you were kind of prepared for it.
Well, I was hoping it wouldn't happen, but yes, I was getting myself prepared for it, I think.
Stephanie, how did you take the news?
Oh, hard. It's nothing you like to see in a loved one.
Yeah. So the news came down in June. It's taken you until really just this month to begin talking about it publicly. How difficult was it for you to go public with this and really tell the world that you have Alzheimer's?
I have had a lot of encouragement from my loving wife, and Stephanie has my best interest, I know, at heart. And I just think it's something maybe we can do to raise public awareness about this and help people understand that some things can be done to address this situation. And we want to do what we can to make this better for other people and for ourselves.
But for you, I gather it was kind of a process to get to this point.
Well, I think it was. It wasn't. I just didn't make this decision overnight.
Yeah.
I didn't make this decision, so I'll call Steve Kraske and tell him.
That was your first mistake, which is always your first mistake. Stephanie, was it a process for you, too, to sort of come to this point?
I think it was. People know I'm a nurse, and I'm very much about being open and aware and talking about things as they come along. There are too many things in our society we don't talk about in time. And Dennis has always been upfront with people about who he is and what he stands for, and this is part of who Dennis Moore is.
Yeah. People will wonder, Congressman, did you ever have a sense, as a member of Congress, perhaps you were dealing or suffering from something like this?
No, I really didn't. I mean, it came later. Maybe it was there and I didn't see it or notice it or something, but I sure didn't.
And so the decision not to run for a seventh term in 2010, that had nothing to do with this?
Absolutely not. I just saw things happening up there. I'd been there for 12 years. That was the end of my 12th year. And maybe I've told people maybe 12 years is my limit. I was DA in Johnson County for 12 years. I was in Congress 12 years. But I'd belonged for several years to a group called the Center Aisle Caucus. And there were about 40, 45 of us, Republicans and Democrats. We met about once a month, nothing fancy, just breakfast or lunch. The whole idea was to develop social relationships and get to know each other and work together on important legislation. It worked. Mm-hmm. And the last year, we stopped meeting because of what was happening up in Congress. And at that point, I kind of just decided, I don't need this anymore. Maybe I've reached my limit.
Yeah, for you, you mentioned that to me when we visited. That was really a pivotal moment for you when that group again sort of disbanded and the Congress seemed to be sort of caving in on itself in some ways, I guess.
That group meant so much to me. I think it was so important, just those developing those social relationships and working together. It wasn't about party, and it was about getting to know each other and working together on legislation. I got those some of those folks signed on my bills, and I signed on some of their legislation, and it worked, and it was just breaking down.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry sort of about the future of Congress with the way the trajectory of the institution right now being what it is?
Well, I do. I'm concerned about that, obviously, but I'm one of these believers that the political pendulum swings sometime to the far left or the far right, and I think right now it's far to one side, needs to center again. I hope and believe it's starting to center again, but it's going to take a little longer than we hope or wish that it would get back to the center, so we'll get back together and start working together.
Our guests today, Dennis and Stephanie Moore, we're also visiting with Michelle Needens, Director of Programs and Public Policy for the Alzheimer's Association. If you want to join our conversation here and visit with the Moores, we'd love to have you. 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Stephanie, how about for you losing the center aisle caucus? I know you shared this journey with your husband so much, his years in Congress. What did that mean for you when that caucus sort of began to break down a little bit?
Well, I could see the disappointment in not just Dennis's eyes, but as well in friends of mine. And I have many friends who are D's and R's. That's the best way to make friends and build bridges.
Yeah.
So it was hurtful when other folks were even saying, you know, no one talks, nobody gets along, and this isn't like it was way back, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So it was disappointing. We all felt it.
816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address again, update@kcur.org. Michelle Needens from the Alzheimer's Association, walk us through the basics here. Remind us exactly what Alzheimer's is and tell us exactly what it is.
Alzheimer's is a progressive degenerative disease in which there are abnormalities in plaque formation that, simply put, kills brain cells both internally and externally. And so there is a trajectory of symptoms that occurs that results in loss of function and memory.
Hmm. And these days there is no known cure?
There is no cure. In present day, there are medications that slow down the functional impact of the disease, and there are other things that we can do, such as exercise that you mentioned formally, that I think slow down the disease. I mean, we're beginning to see all kinds of encouraging research around that area and others.
Your wife's been on you about exercising, Congressman. Are you getting that job done?
What do you mean? Yes, she has been on me about exercising, and I listen to my nurse when she talks to me about health issues. And
yeah. And
I, in fact, was out this morning. I've started trying to walk every morning for about half a mile to a mile every morning.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, will you verify that, in fact, he was out this morning and doing what he needs to do?
He was out there walking this morning. I was very proud of him, and I'm taking care of a bad knee, so I was on a little machine in the house, but I didn't get to join him today.
Well, why is exercise considered to be important, Michelle?
Well, I think there is multifactorial issues that contribute to Alzheimer's disease. So when we look at our brain functioning, we're really looking at a bank account in some respect, and the more nerve cells we have, the more we can lose before it crosses some line in terms of functional implication. So part of it may be attached to some of that, building the bank account. Part of it may be related to cardiovascular issues, which we now know are attached to risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. When we look at blood pressure, cholesterol, and diabetes, those kinds of things. So I don't know that we know the entire answer of why exercise works, but we're beginning to know more about it, and those are some of the features.
You mentioned a few minutes ago there is no known cure. What are the prospects for that in the next 10, 15 years?
Oh, I think we will see more significant disease-modifying medication first. And I do think we will get to a cure. I don't have projections. I don't think there's any researcher out there that would give you projections of a cure, but I think we're closer to disease-modifying medication. And the interesting and really exciting thing is we're also looking at earlier diagnosis. So if we do things such as spinal taps and be able to see Alzheimer's disease before symptoms start, and then be able to treat with disease-modifying medication that halts the process, that in essence would be a cure.
Wow. Wow.
So we're
That's
getting
exciting.
There.
Yeah.
It's going to take a while, and there's lots of silos of research going on. And I think all of them give us powerful, powerful hope.
Well, Michelle, work harder and faster, okay?
Lots of phone calls here for Dennis and Stephanie Moore. Let's go to them right now. Beth from Lone Jack. Beth, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Beth.
Hi. I just wanted to ask two things. You've talked about the genetic component. So my real question was, well, what if your parents die fairly young in life? I mean, you know, 57, 60. How do you know if a grandparent had dementia? How do you know you don't know if one of your parents didn't have that? You know, and then you were just talking about the medications, and I'd like to hear more about the progress on that.
Yeah, thank you, Beth. Go ahead, Michelle.
Well, really, when we think about Alzheimer's disease and kind of the history of that, I think there are many people that were our grandparents' age that were not diagnosed. I remember when I was a kid growing up in Parsons, Kansas, I never heard the word Alzheimer's disease. What I heard was hardening of the arteries,
mm-hmm.
maybe senility.
Right.
But we did not know enough. So maybe none of us really know fully what our history is and who in our ancestry would have had Alzheimer's disease. And for that, we cannot worry. In fact, if we have family members with the disease, I still say don't worry, just be attentive. So the short answer to that is be attentive to the early signs of Alzheimer's, whether you have history or don't. And if you have a concern, a gut-level feeling, something's wrong, have a conversation with your physician.
Is there a way to find out these days, through DNA, if a grandparent or parent, for that matter, Michelle, had it or not?
No. There are genetic testing that can show if you have the genetic mutations attached to the familial variety. We have the science right now to be able to genetically test individuals for that what's often called the Alzheimer's gene. Now, do we encourage people to do that genetic testing? Absolutely not. I mean, we don't really know what the translation rate, and research is all over the place.
What do you mean translation rate?
So if I carry one of those mutations, if I have, quote, the Alzheimer's gene, then will I for sure get the disease? No. What's mm-hmm. my percentage of getting that disease? Research is variable. Some say as low as 18%, some up to 47%. So if I carry the Alzheimer's gene, do you know what my life is going to be? If I know that,
mm-hmm. okay,
I will stew about. So until we have serious disease modifying medications, that kind of genetic testing should be left to the academic world. It is necessary and important for science from a clinical perspective. That's not something that we encourage.
Our caller also had a question about the medications, and I gather she wanted to know how close some of those medications are to coming to market, being available for folks who might be suffering.
All I can say is some of those medications are in phase 3 FDA trials.
Is that the final phase?
That, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And those, in terms of the results and the success and how significantly modify, vary all over the place. So I have no projections. I doubt that we will know that much until the day it comes on the market. I think there are surprises that can occur with a scientific discovery, and we'll all keep our fingers crossed.
We'll tell the Food and Drug Administration to hurry up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if people out there listening, Michelle, want more information about this, a good website, I assume, is the Alzheimer's Association itself. What is that website?
ALZ.org.
Very simple.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's a place to click on In My Community, and you can go to the community that serves you in terms of those chapter territories, and there are chapters all over the country. So even if you have a parent or loved one in another state, you can get information about local chapters in those areas.
Okay, back to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Again, our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Let's go to Cheryl from Liberty. Cheryl, you're on the program. Good morning.
Good morning. I was curious. My mom was diagnosed with dementia a couple years ago, and until my family and I did research, we kind of interchangeably used the word Alzheimer's and dementia, and I finally looked it up and got an idea of what each one, and they tested her differently and ruled out Alzheimer's because of I believe it was a brain scan is how they did it. So I was just curious what the main difference is between dementia and Alzheimer's. And I apologize, I did get in kind of late, so if you had mentioned it before, I apologize.
No, that's a great question, Cheryl. Michelle?
Dementia is an umbrella term. It simply means that there's something progressively occurring in the brain. So it doesn't tell us much. It's like saying someone has cancer, and there are many kinds of cancer. So Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. 70% of the time, it is Alzheimer's dementia. Mm-hmm. So if we looked in a medical chart, it would say dementia of the probable Alzheimer's type 70% of the time. Now, when when you talk about that Alzheimer's was ruled out and they did so via the scan, it may very well have been that they saw some sort of vascular implication in the brain scan that led them to think perhaps vascular dementia. You know, you could see many strokes, for example, in the brain, mm-hmm. white matter disease. So it may be that they saw evidence in the brain scan of those kind of phenomena. And there are important differences between the various dementias, and very important to know what type of dementia, because if you are a family member going through this, if you are a person with the disease going through this, you need to know what to anticipate in the disease. You need to be one step ahead of whatever crisis could occur, whatever challenge could occur, so that we can prevent some of the most difficult experiences through this disease mm-hmm. process.
You know, Stephanie Moore, I'm wondering about the reaction to the story in the newspaper. I know you did an interview on Channel 41 as well. What kind of response did you all get to this news coming out?
Well, we've had a wonderful outpouring of support and love. It's just been very, very, very nice to hear that from everyone. Lots of folks sending me advice, which has been fun to hear too. And
are you sharing that with me?
Yes, I am, honey. But it's just been really great.
Well, I had an outpouring of reaction at the newspaper as well when the story came out. And one thing I heard a whole lot about was coconut oil. Coconut something. Michelle, what is that and how effective is it? And Stephanie's holding a jar of it as we speak here. She's handing it to me now. It's coconut oil, organic, extra virgin. What is this?
Well, and maybe Stephanie, you want to comment on this. I guess the short answer is there's no hard evidence that the coconut oil works. Am I a believer that we have done sufficient research on everything out there to rule anything out? No. And if I'm a family member or person with the disease, am I willing to consider things that are untested and unproven? I very well may be. So there's not any hard evidence. You know, there was a video clip on the internet that indicated that the coconut oil was a cure. I wish that was the case. I don't rule out that it may be helpful in some way. We'll see.
But Stephanie, you've bought some. You've got some cooking oil right there.
Well, you know, so many folks yes. said, try the coconut oil. So we went out and I said, well, let's give it a try. And we tried different ways of eating this. It tastes a little bit and looks a lot like Crisco for people, mm-hmm. except it has a nice coconut flavor. And Dennis likes that. So I've been
and
making.
And when my nurse and my wife tell me to take coconut oil, I say yes, dear.
Yeah. Well, we have discovered that it doesn't taste bad if you mix it with yogurt and fresh fruit and a little milk and stir it up. And if you use pineapple and rum, you've almost got a pina colada.
Well, we don't use the rum, honey. We skip the rum. But
no, we haven't yet.
Yeah, it is pretty good. It really tastes like a milkshake almost when you put some yogurt in it. And
But as far as the research, there is none, as Michelle said, of whether it actually works or not. But it's not going to hurt you. Two mm-hmm. tablespoons of this a day is not going to hurt you, and it tastes yummy. And
why not? Right, absolutely. Email here from Pam from Kansas City who writes, my dad suffered from dementia for almost 13 years. The Alzheimer's Association guided us through our journey with compassion and understanding. Mm-hmm. Today is the 10th anniversary of his funeral. I offer the Moores my prayers on the journey they will take and encourage them and letting them know they are not alone. Michelle Needens is our angel, she writes.
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that nice?
We agree already. Absolutely. We've just met the folks at the Heart of America chapter, and they're delightful.
Wonderful people, wonderful association.
Great resource.
Absolutely.
Well, on that note, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Dennis and Stephanie Moore and also with Michelle Needens from the Alzheimer's Association. We'll take your phone calls at 816-235-2888 and our email address up-to-date at kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our visit yesterday with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill and our talk with actress Sondra McLean about the late Congresswoman and civil rights activist Barbara Jordan, you'll find them on all of our older broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a newly minted U.S. citizen tells us about his immigration story to America and that of Germans to Missouri in the early 1900s. It's the subject of Alex George's new book, A Good American. Also, Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. This hour, we're visiting with Dennis and Stephanie Moore, also with Michelle Needens, a Director of Programs and Public Policy for the Alzheimer's Association, the Heart of America chapter. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address is up-to-date at kcur.org. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Some folks have been waiting very patiently. Michelle from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. Hi. This is a question about the relationship between Down syndrome and Alzheimer's. And I don't want to go into anything further because I'm not sure I have it correctly. I think that it's the children who are born with Down syndrome tend to get Alzheimer's or later in life, and there's a connection, gene connection, or they're just starting the research on that, and I didn't know if you had anything to say about that.
Michelle, thank you for the call. Michelle, connection between Downs and Alzheimer's.
Yes, the caller has it right.
Really?
There's a genetic link, and if you have Down syndrome, you've got about a 99% chance of getting Alzheimer's disease. And because with Down syndrome, you age precociously, you also get the disease earlier. So the average age of onset of Alzheimer's disease in the Downs population is in early 50s. Mm. And because sometimes Down syndrome, the behaviors attached and some of the challenges attached to Down syndrome can look similar to some of the symptoms and presentation of Alzheimer's disease, any family member of a person with Down syndrome should pay close attention and advocate when they start seeing changes so that people are not just labeled with this disease or another, but that we respond and pay attention to the subtleties of those changes.
Okay. Let's go to Ed from Kansas City, Kansas. Ed, you're on the program. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Well, I've had the privilege on a few occasions of hearing Congressman Moore play his guitar, and I was curious if there is an impact on the progression of the disease to practice something like that, or conversely, if the disease has an impact on the ability to continue doing activity like that.
Hmm. How about musical activity, Michelle?
Well, musical activity is what I would consider, and Congressman, I'm sure you would agree with me, it's a soul piece. It's
S-O-L-E.
Yeah. S-O-U-L.
Right, I guess.
It is a, it lives in our heart and being. And so feelings are protected in the disease process. What I consider the soul pieces are protected. So we are going to have the beautiful opportunity of hearing Congressman Moore play his guitar for many, many years.
He played it for me last week.
Absolutely.
Played it pretty well.
And Stephanie encourages me to play more, and I've sort of slowed down some, and I really want to start playing again. I used to play with some lawyer friends around Johnson County, and I want to get some of those folks together and start meeting maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks and playing.
I think you played that guitar once for someone named Carol King. Am I right about that?
Carol King. Is that Carol, a Christmas Carol? Oh, yeah. Carol King, yes, yes. We got to play together once, and that was wonderful, really.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful performer.
And what a great prop, I guess, it might be the right word, on the campaign trail. That served you pretty well for a lot of years.
I'm not familiar with the term prop. Is that a technical term?
It might have been a bad choice of words. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. People really seem to enjoy it when you get the guitar out and play it and have them sing along. This land is your land, which I said could have been our national anthem, you know, for our country, the greatest country in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Dennis and Stephanie Moore are our guests. Our email address, again, update@kcur.org. Congressman, do you miss being in Congress, or, again, are you sort of glad that's in your rearview mirror right now?
I am, with what's happening up there right now, I'm really kind of glad it's in my rearview mirror. I mean, I really enjoyed it while I was there. I think I did some good things for our people and our country, made some really good friends, and did some good work. But maybe I've told people, too, maybe 12 years is my limit. I was DA in Johnson County for 12 years. I was in Congress 12 years, and I just said that's all I can take right now.
Was your experience in Congress, was it what you thought it was going to be when you first went there, in 1999?
Yeah. Yes.
Was it what you thought it was going to be?
Well, yes. I have known people who've been in Congress before, and I worked for a guy named Bill Roy, who was from Topeka, and I worked on his first campaign, and he's one of my really a good friend, mm-hmm. and a hero to me. And I think I knew what to expect, and I really found it to be the case, and I think I was able to accomplish some good things while I was there. But it was not altogether pleasant, but for the most part, it was a very positive experience.
How confusing was it at first, trying to figure out how to navigate an institution like that and begin to make a difference? I imagine that had to have been fairly tricky.
Well, it is tricky. I think it might have been helpful to have some experience in the state legislature or something, just working with legislation, which I did not do.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a very good staff, frankly, Howard Bolicki. Was my chief of staff.
Who used to be Kerry McCarthy's chief of staff.
Yes,
yeah.
And Howard and my other staff members were very helpful to me and guided me along here. And I was on the Financial Services Committee and on a couple of other committees. But that was the primary committee I served on, was Financial Services, with a guy named Congressman Barney Frank. And mm-hmm. I had amazing experiences there doing some good stuff for our country, I think.
Barney Frank is quite a character, isn't he?
He is, but he's a character, as you say, but he's maybe one of the brightest guys in Congress in terms of intellect, and he means well, and he really tries to do the right thing, and I got the nicest handwritten note from Barney, and I was on that Financial Services Committee for 12 years, and I've never seen him handwrite a note. He's always had his staff do it.
Yeah.
And it was just the nicest note.
He just announced he's stepping down himself, right?
I heard that, yes.
Yeah. Stephanie, what kind of experience was Washington for you as a spouse of a member of Congress? How did it go for you?
Well, it was a wonderful experience most of the time. I enjoy politics. My grandfather was involved in politics in Illinois. He was born in 1881, so it was a long time ago that he was involved before I was even born. But I grew up hearing stories and enjoyed it very much. And I was more the political wife than the white gloves and Tea Party type of wife.
The difference being?
Being I would actively campaign with my husband. There are many things that I could have gotten involved with, and I did in D.C., going to lectures and hearing wonderful speakers, the opportunity to educate myself on so many issues. And I really, really enjoyed that. And I liked the interaction with the constituents. It was marvelous.
No, go ahead.
Can I just mention, too, since you ask about her family, my dad had been county attorney down in Wichita for 6 years. He ran for Congress in 1958. Warner Moore lost by 2,000 votes to a 22-year incumbent, so I think he was a great inspiration to me because I kind of followed in his footsteps as far as running for district attorney later, and I won that and was there for 12 years, and then I ran for Congress and I was there for 12 years.
Yeah.
And I just learned a lot from my dad, really.
Dennis and Stephanie Moore are here today speaking out about the congressman's recent diagnosis of Alzheimer's. Our number here, 816-235-2888. What do you think of that? 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Stephanie, how close are the spouses of members of Congress? Is there a group out there that sort of gets together and hangs, or how does that work?
Well, when you first arrive, you're welcomed by the spouse group of your particular party, and then you're put into a mix, something called the Congressional Club. It's where the ladies all, and the gentlemen now, all get together and get to know one another, and politics is dropped at the front door. You just get to know each other as people, and I've made wonderful friends, not even knowing what party they were, and that's very, 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 very helpful.
So the spouses sort of get along. It's the members themselves that struggle a little bit.
Well, sometimes.
Yeah.
There are some spouses who are have very strong opinions and take things extremely personally, which you cannot do in politics. You know that.
Yeah.
Some things can be said in a campaign that someone was encouraged to say, whether it was true or not, and you have to mend your fences and realize that that's part of the game of politics, quite sadly.
But again, trailing on what Stephanie said, I think those social relationships, whether it's the members of Congress or spouses, is so important to developing those, you know, just friendly relationships. And then when you have differences, at least be civil and respectful and try to resolve those and get along.
You know, when I was visiting your house, you told me, Congressman, how many amazing experiences you had while you were a member of Congress. And you showed me to your den, and you had some very interesting photographs about some of your experiences while serving as a member of Congress. And there was one of you next to a hole. There's really no other word for it, where Saddam Hussein had been captured in Iraq, which just amazed me. Tell us about being there and how you wound up there to begin with.
I was invited, along with a few other members of Congress, to go over there to see firsthand what had happened. We met with some of the leadership over there, but it was just an emotional experience to go up there. And they said, pointed at the little hole right there, this is where Saddam Hussein was captured. And, I mean, I've got a photograph of myself, I believe, with a colonel from the United States Army who was there. And, I mean, it was just an emotional experience thinking the horrible things he did to people and that finally they got him.
You know? Dennis, didn't they have you the opportunity to go down into that spider hole? Wasn't it called a spider hole?
Yeah, I think that's right.
I didn't want to be a spider, so I declined.
Was it just a hole in the ground, or was there like a...
No, it was a hole in the ground.
And there he was.
It was what they commonly call a manhole.
Yeah.
Seriously.
You had some other photographs there, a photograph of you with Fidel Castro, of all people. You were in Cuba. Why? What do you recall about that trip?
Well, a group, again, a bipartisan group, I think there were six or eight of us, were invited to come down to Cuba and meet with Premier Castro, and we did. And I think it is so, so very important to develop those relationships with other nations, especially the ones with whom we have profound differences, and try to resolve those differences and understand that we have a lot more in common than we have differences, and look for those things we have in common, build on those, and resolve the differences.
Yeah.
And he was very... He was very friendly when we met with him, and I mean, it was just a very positive experience.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to some phone calls here and go to Gwen from Independence. Gwen, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. I want to just encourage that people maybe get second opinions. My father-in-law was diagnosed with Alzheimer's by his family doctor, and anyway, bottom line, one of his daughters had taught in medical school and lived in another part of the country, and she later got him to have a thorough workup. They found out that he had a brain tumor. It wasn't Alzheimer's, and if they had found it sooner and gotten a shunt in and gotten liquid off and all that sort of thing, he would have had the brain damage. He ended up, you know, with a kind of dementia-like life then, and the family doctor wrote on his death certificate Alzheimer's, but it was actually a brain tumor that had not been found. So that's all I wanted to say. Just make sure that it's the right diagnosis.
Right. Anything you want to add to that, Michelle?
I would just say the key word in what she just said was thorough dementia evaluation. Too often people are diagnosed via a five-minute conversation in a medical office, and we cannot see things like brain tumors and hydrocephalus and other things in a five-minute conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So just because you're of a certain age does not mean you are not worthy, nor is it not necessary to go through a thorough dementia evaluation. So that would include a brain scan and neuropsych testing and full lab work and thorough clinical history. So, yes, there's some rule-out pieces, and yes, there are some elements that guide us in a certain way, but very, very important. It's one reason why it's important to look at early detection is because there are things that are reversible Memory problems, no matter what age you are, does not necessarily mean that you have Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. And my gosh, if there's something reversible, let's proceed. And even if it's irreversible, it may be something else that indicates another set of interventions.
Mm-hmm.
Important to find doctors who know something about Alzheimer's disease, and neurologists tend to be the best specialty to go to. Although we have fine family practice doctors that are expert in that field, geriatricians that are expert in the field, and geriatric psychiatry that is expert in the field. But find someone who knows and who takes your complaint seriously.
Mm-hmm. So someone listening, if they're concerned about a loved one, suspicious perhaps they might have Alzheimer's, they should do what? What are two or three things, Michelle, that should be takeaways from this program for people listening? What should they do?
Well, I say, first of all, trust your gut. Stop convincing yourself that it isn't so. So quit talking yourself out of it. If you think there is something wrong, if you see differences that are shocking and alarming, don't ask your friend who will say we all forget. Don't ask someone who's not expert to disqualify your gut feeling. Listen to your gut and have a conversation with the doctor. And if you are not taken seriously, absolutely find someone who takes you seriously.
Frank writes us this, my mother-in-law is progressing into full-blown Alzheimer's. I wish I knew how to comfort my wife and sister-in-law, although they both realize the inevitable result. Thanks for the discussion today and for Dennis Moore being courageous enough to bring his struggles to the public. Again, how to comfort someone's wife, would you say, Michelle, in a situation like that?
Comfort is different than fix. So we allow people to grieve the losses that are associated with Alzheimer's disease that is necessary, so what he can do is listen.
Mm-hmm.
Ask, listen, be a part. There's beautiful, beautiful moments and things that can happen in this disease process. Look for them. Look for them.
And I want to thank Stephanie again, too, for encouraging me to step forward here and bring this to public attention,
yeah,
because I think there needs to be more public discussion and understanding about this whole process and this disease. And hopefully, as a result of some of that, we're going to find, get more attention to it and find some, quote, cures in the future.
And I can't tell you, Congressman, how many phone calls and emails I had at the newspaper thanking us for doing this story, thanking you for agreeing to do this story, yeah, and really expressing calling you heroic for stepping forward and doing what you've done here. And I think that's a pretty good word for it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Back to some phone calls here. Patricia from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on with Dennis and Stephanie Moore. Patricia, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Steve Kraske. I want to thank Stephanie and Dennis Moore and Michelle for being on this program with you. And my question for Michelle was, how important are support groups for the loved ones and the caregivers?
How about support groups, Michelle?
I think support groups are very, very important because everybody in the room has some experience that is shared. That is known at a full understanding emotionally as well as logistically.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very important. Are support groups for everybody? No. Are they for most people? Yes. Are they for most people, including those who immediately rule them out? Yes. So I say don't rule them out. Test it out and find if that is the avenue for you before you decide that you're going to try this on your own.
And we went yesterday for the first time to a support group, and I just thought it was a very positive experience. And I'm going to go back on a regular basis. There are people there that care. Most of those folks that were there have this diagnosis right now. And we're able to share some conversations, some experiences, but it was a very positive experience, and I'm looking forward to it in the future. I thank Stephanie again for encouraging me to get involved in that.
You went with them, Stephanie?
Well, there is a wonderful arrangement where I got to go into a separate group, which is for caregivers, people who their parent, their spouse, their loved one has received an early diagnosis, and they're dealing with it. And it was very reassuring to know that you're not there alone. And
yeah,
I absolutely encourage people to do that. One thing that I'm very happy of is that I feel more comfortable doing that now. Before,
absolutely,
I just didn't want to do that because I knew the cat would be out of the bag without us doing it on our own time.
Yeah. Well, the cat's out of the bag now, honey.
Yeah.
I would mention one thing, Steve, that I want to be sure and bring up is that something I wasn't expecting that has come out of this is the number of people, some people we know and some strangers who come up to us and say, can I talk to you for just a moment? I'm concerned about my parent, about my child, about my spouse, or about myself.
Right.
And I've been very happy to refer them to the Heart of America chapter, to Michelle and to Deborah Brooke, their executive director, and encourage them to visit with their physician. Some have said their physician has sort of not taken them seriously, and I've encouraged them to do what Michelle has suggested, and that is to find someone to give them a thorough examination. And I do hope that people will do that.
Interesting email here from Lisa from Kansas City, Missouri. My mother had Alzheimer's, she writes, and passed away about 10 years ago. Sadly, she was never able to talk openly with me and my siblings about her disease. We had to make decisions for her without her input because of that. I don't judge her about that. I know she dealt with it the best she could. I commend you on your openness with the public and especially with your loved ones. I think it will have a positive impact on your life and your family's life as you go through the stages together. I wish you many more years of happiness and memory building with your wife and family.
What a
nice note from Lisa.
That's very nice.
Absolutely. Let's go to Philip from Mission. Philip, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Yes. I would like to thank Congressman Moore for his 12 years of service to the 3rd Congressional District and all the work that he did for veterans. And I'm a Vietnam veteran. I greatly appreciate all the bills and everything that he do for veterans.
Philip, thank you.
What a nice thing. Philip, thank you for calling and saying that. And I just do want to say two bills I did that I'll be forever proud of. One was to increase the military death gratuity from $12,000 to $100,000. I thought for $12,000, if you had somebody die in a big family around the country, you couldn't even pay to fly them in for a funeral. And the other, just paying for troop travel when they're coming back from Iraq or wherever. And I just, they're putting them down on the East Coast and they're told from here, you pay your own way home. And I thought that is not right. And I filed a bill. They're both law. And I just think whether we agree or disagree with the policy that puts our troops someplace, we have an absolute responsibility to support our troops, their families, and our veterans.
Philip, thank you for the good call. I appreciate it.
Thank you for allowing me to call in.
You bet. Congressman, you talked in our interview about your concerns about the campaign cycle every 2 years. And, Stephanie, you talked about that, too. You look back over the years at the opponents you faced every 2 years, Adam Taft, Chris Kobach, Phil Klein, Vince Snowbarger, the incumbent to begin with. That was really a journey for you and an arduous one, not to mention the challenges of the job and flying out to D.C. every week. You mentioned that you think it's a good idea to go to 4-year terms for members of the U.S. House as opposed to 2 years. How come?
I just think when you're faced with the prospect of re-election or running for re-election every 2 years, you wouldn't believe how much time members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, have to spend down, not in their office, because that's not ethical to do that, but going down to the Republican National Headquarters, Democratic Headquarters, sitting there for an hour, 2 hours an afternoon, calling people, asking for contributions. And, I mean, we could better spend time doing other things, and I'm not saying that the senators have 6-year terms. I'm not proposing 6-year terms for House members, but what I thought seriously about, and I didn't do it, and I wish the heck I'd done it in retrospect, was a constitutional amendment to provide for 4-year terms with half elected every 2 years and overlapping terms. And 4-year terms, I think, would give people time to do their job, not worry spending all that time calling people, asking for money in re-election, and working for their people and their country, which is what needs to happen.
You spent time with Carole King and others. Stephanie, what are some of your favorite memories of folks that you got to meet as a result of having a spouse who was a member of Congress?
Well, it was exciting, of course, and a lot of the photos you've seen, I was the one taking the picture, so, so I got to meet a lot of those folks as well. But again, I just go back to the education that I got from all of this of learning. A lot of the Hollywood celebrities and the music industry folks are supporting different causes, so there was a great opportunity to learn about different causes as well as meet some nice people, policymakers from years ago, retired members of the House and the Senate and former, just former cabinet members. It was incredible. It really was. But I want to get back to the Alzheimer's and what we're doing and how Dennis and I are involved with it.
Michelle, a question for you. Christian in Overland Park writes this. Could you ask about the importance of health care, power of attorney, and living will discussions since decision-making is impaired as the disease advances? Again, thanks so much for highlighting Dennis and his family today.
Yes. Alzheimer's oftentimes people will think as a disease that takes control away from the person with the disease. I think in the early stages it is kind of the opposite. So I think if you have discussions very early on about health care plans, about how I see the future, then it allows the person with the disease to stay in control. Mm-hmm. So the earlier those discussions, I mean, all of us should have health care directives right now, with or without the disease. We should all have durable power of attorney and have a plan in place.
That's a good note to end on, a good mm-hmm. advice to end on as well. And Congressman, thanks so much for taking some time today. It's great to see you.
Thanks for coming in today. Great to see you, too.
You bet. Stephanie, always good to have you, too.
Happy to be here.
You bet.
Come back anytime.
Michelle Needens from the Alzheimer's Association, thanks so much to you, too.
Thank you.
Great advice, great counsel today. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow on the program, author of The Good American, Alex George, plus Brian McTavish's Weekend To-Do List. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, Suzanne Hogan, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.